What does it take to do the impossible? What does it take to level up your game like never before? What does it take for individuals, organizations, for even institutions to achieve paradigm shifting, nothing is ever the same again, breakthroughs?
Our mission is to decode the neurobiology of flow and cognitive peak performance. Access the minds of maverick scientists, groundbreaking innovators, and world-leading experts to understand what it takes to achieve ultimate human performance. So you can feel your best, perform your best, and accomplish your boldest goals. I'm your host, Rian Darris, and together with best-selling author Stephen Kotler, I present to you Flow Research Collective Radio. Welcome to a new episode of Flow Research Collective Radio. I'm excited about today's episode. It is the second half of a really fun discussion between myself, our Chief Science Officer here at the Flow Research Collective, and Andrew Scottsco, who is the host of the Enliven podcast. He's also an incredible tech entrepreneur and just amazing interviewer all around. And this interview ended up being a 3-hour marathon. You can check out the first half of it on the podcast from last week, but today we're going to be wrapping up the second half, and it's a fun opportunity to get to know myself and Connor a little bit better if you want to get a deeper sense of where our thoughts land with flow, peak performance, and all of the things that we talk about here at the Flow Research Collective. And in this second half, we talk about why clear goals as a flow trigger is so crucial, how the emphasis on distraction, elimination, and focus for flow can be reconciled with the emphasis needed on group flow and collaboration within the workplace. How do you stay hyper-focused individually and also create a culture that fosters collaboration and innovation? It's a tricky thing. We talk about how to reconcile those two. We also go into the difference between the flow cycle and the flow trigger. So it's a fun episode. If you've already caught the first half, then hopefully you're up for listening to the second half already. And if not, feel free to go back, listen to that first half, and then come back and join us here afterwards. Now, before I jump in, I want to make a quick announcement from the Flow Research Collective. We are currently accepting a number of new participants into our flagship Flow Training Zero to Dangerous. Zero to Dangerous is designed to help you work towards spending your entire workday in that zone, that state of flow, where you are hyper-productive, massively creative, where learning is enhanced, where effort feels effortless, and where many of our best work ends up coming from. So if you want to learn how to do that with neuroscience-backed peak performance practices, habits, and protocols, all with the guidance of a PhD-level performance coach who you'll work with one-on-one, Zero to Dangerous may be a fit for you. If you want to apply for Zero to Dangerous and see if it actually is a fit, then just go to getmoreflow.com. You can drop a quick application through there. We will speak with you. We'll see if it's a good fit. We'll give you more info on exactly how it works and what's involved. So it's getmoreflow.com if that's of interest. Now, let's jump back into the chat with myself, Connor, and Andrew. I think you're going to enjoy this one today.
We can go deeper into the triggers. I mean,
another one I think that's worth touching on is clear goals. Mm. And it's super helpful, I think, for knowledge work specifically. So, it's basic, but essentially clear goals is just having a very clear, specific goal for whatever task that it is you're engaging with or doing at the moment. So when the goal is clear, the mind doesn't kind of wander. You don't go into high level analytical mode of kind of being concerned about exactly what it is that you're supposed to be doing and what the purpose of it is, but you're able to just kind of focus, hone in, and drop straight into whatever it is that you're doing. So making a very intentional effort to always have extremely, extremely clear goals with respect to anything you're doing, I think helps.
Could you give a concrete example? Because I've heard you talk about this elsewhere. And one of the things, there's two things I'd like you to go deeper on as it relates to the clear goals bit. One was the distinction between, I think this is in a recent newsletter you all did, between sort of high level hard goals and like clear goals, because I think people hear clear goals and I can imagine 10 people having 10 different interpretations of what that means.
Yeah.
So if you could make that distinction there and then give a concrete example, when you say clear goal, what does that actually look like versus what someone might be thinking?
Yeah. So obviously there's different kind of levels of goals, and we, within the Flow Research Collective, start at what Stephen calls your massively transformative purpose, which is your overall
overarching life vision mission that is essentially endless. It's kind of like a infinite game type thing. Then you've got your high hard goals, then maybe 10-year goals, 5-year goals, 1-year goals, and then it just kind of cascades down to usually the immediate task level of, okay, I want to spend 2 hours doing X. And then within that, you need clear goals. And I think most people go wrong with clear goals by not making them clear enough. They need to be hyper, kind of freakishly clear down to an insanely detailed level. And a good proxy for knowing whether your goals are clear enough is whether you feel a sense of resistance to doing the tasks. So if you feel resistance, if you feel this kind of desire to procrastinate, or if you feel like you can't just kind of effortlessly slip and sink right into what it is that you're doing, you probably haven't set enough time getting crystal clear on the goals of the task, the exact first thing you need to do to start, the subcomponents of the task. So let's take an example like writing. Rather than saying, you know, I'm going to write for 2 hours, you say, okay, I'm going to write 700 words. And the first step is going to be writing the 6 outlines. The second step is going to be researching the material I need to populate each of those outlines. The third step is going to be doing an edit of outline 1, the fourth step, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just all locked out. And so all of that, again, high level kind of analytical work is done and separated out. And then you can just drop into the actual execution of what it is. So another way I like to think about it is separating strategy and execution. And that's super helpful. So get all that stuff done and then boom, just mindlessly, hence flow, drop into the actual execution of the thing.
Right. My simple rule of thumb is if at the end of that task, like if I'm asking myself, you know, I'm looking at my to-do list, like, did I complete this task? If I'm sitting there wondering if I completed the task, the goal wasn't clear enough.
Yeah, right,
so,
exactly.
So oftentimes,
yeah.
Like, you know, if the goal is like, okay, I need to do research on this, right? Like I need to like do like research on like this subject matter in order to be able to do the next step of this project. For that, like I always need to time box that. I'm always like, okay, I'm going to do 1 hour of research. I'm going to cap it at that. And so that way I'm not sitting here being like, oh, did I actually complete that goal, right? Like, so that's like the general rule of thumb that makes it really, really helpful for me. I think the other thing that's like really helpful to talk about it, and I don't think enough people talk about this in the flow community, which is like entropy versus flow. So we talked a little bit about, like flow is a spectrum from micro flow to macro flow, and macro flow are, you know, these, you know, incredibly intense states that oftentimes, you know, like a lot of people describe them resembling some sort of mystical state, right? So like macro flow is qualitatively different from micro flow, but what's the opposite of flow? I think that's like a really important question to ask. And so what Csikszentmihalyi talks about in some of the original research is, you know, it's about entropy versus flow. And so if you think about like like cognitive entropy as, you know, your mind is like kind of scattered between a number of different things, right? Your mind is a goal directed system, right? So it's looking for goals, and maybe you're scattered between a number of different goals. You don't know what like you actually want to spend time on. Like if you think about like your, like how entropic your like mental state is, and apologize if I'm being too esoteric.
You mean sort of like scattered?
Exactly. Because you waste so many resources worrying about things that you shouldn't be worrying about, or thinking about things that you shouldn't be thinking about. And flow is to a certain extent the opposite of that, right? Because in flow, like, you know, flow is a game of attention. It's when your attention is completely focused on the present. And when your attention is completely focused on the present, you're not worrying about the past. You're not worrying about the future. Like you're not wasting all of these cognitive resources, just burning calories on, you know, static and entropy, basically.
Right.
And so the mechanism of clear goals is designed to leverage that goal-directed system and get you as focused as possible on one given thing, so that, you know, you're not burning too many calories on the noise.
Yeah, you want to sort of proactively facilitate the presence or flow by getting that like entropic work out of the way in advance, constantly, systematically, as just part of your process, rather than, you know, the first half of your workday involving doing that. You should have a process in place that gets that stuff done separately, consistently, so that again, you can just drop straight in.
Exactly. So how do you two do that? Like, what's your process for doing that on a regular basis?
Every night, I'm pretty extreme with it.
hey, to the point you made earlier, like people underestimate the power of taking simple things to extreme levels. So maybe this is a good case study.
Yeah, and it's a good point. I mean, a lot of this stuff, a lot of our training, you know, I think when we talk about flow and we go into the neuroscience of it, people assume that the training is going to involve all of these really complex, mysterious, you know, in-depth bizarre hacks and tools and tips, but a lot of it is extremely simple stuff that oftentimes is so simple people underestimate its effect or efficacy. So what I do, I have a monthly process as well for it, but I have a weekly process for basically mapping out my entire week in blocks. And I call that like my kind of strategy session. I usually do that on a Sunday morning. And so I'll map out the week at a high level, all of what I need to do, all of my goals, and try and block it all straight onto my calendar. And that means I can hit Monday morning without wondering anything really. And obviously there's movement there. You know, I need to be able to adapt to what's actually happening during the week, but it gets all of that stuff out of the way in advance of the week so that I can get in and just execute and forget about, you know, where I'm going or what I'm doing or what path I need to take. I'm just running down a path for the entire week. And then I do a smaller micro version of that every night, like a, I call it like a power down ritual kind of thing, where basically I'll finish the work day, review what I've done, look at, you know, the weekly objectives, map them all out, and then in pretty extreme detail, calendar the next day, usually by the hour, depending on the task. And I'll set clear goals for each task that evening as well and line up everything that's needed to begin those tasks. Again, a huge part of procrastination and a huge part of people's challenge actually getting into work is that they've got all this like clutter they need to deal with before they can start the thing they're actually supposed to be doing. So you want to get all that stuff done ideally the evening before, and you want to get clear on what it is that you're doing. And then you wake up in the morning, all of that, your previous self has taken care of all of that high level work, and you can just drop straight in and execute. And it makes a huge difference, I find, for flow. And then also, I mean, outside of flow, it's very helpful for just, you know, generally working on the right things, kind of picking or defining or identifying the unlocking moves that are going to be more effective for your overall long-term goals. So flow is conducive to just better decision-making anyway, even though you're, you know, you're doing that decision-making not necessarily in a flow state the night before or on your Sunday morning session.
Right. Yeah. And So my, the process that I use closely mimics, Rianne's, but for me, like it's really helpful to differentiate convergent and divergent tasks. And I think like that distinction is so important. And so for instance, for divergent tasks where you're, you know, creatively trying to think of, you know, what am I going to do? Like you're like, you know, creative problem solving for that. Like people are, you know, you follow these circadian rhythms, right? Day after day. And people are systematically better at doing one or the other in the morning or the evening. Mm-hmm. And so generally speaking, people tend to be better at divergent tasks, right? Creative problem solving, strategizing, that sort of thing in the afternoon. And they tend to be better at convergent tasks where they drill down into a given domain with some, you know, narrowly defined clear goals in advance in the morning. And so like that's the strategy that I use, which is, you know, you need some sort of block of uninterrupted time, like first thing in the morning. Those clear goals should always be determined the night before. So similar to what Rihanna is saying, you're not just spinning your wheels trying to figure out what you should focus on, because that's the worst use of time possible. And so like drilling down into that first thing in the morning, and then in the afternoon, taking that for your like strategizing, figuring out what you're going to do in the next day, that sort of thing, is just so crucial.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love that. I mean, strategy is divergent. Execution is convergent, is another way to think about it. And a lot of people who don't have the language of flow talk about and advise you to do very similar things. Like I think it's Paul Graham.
Yeah, Paul Graham
has an amazing article called Maker versus Manager Schedule. And he advises you to do basically a very, very similar thing, which is that during your morning block, you really protect your time, you protect your attention, you do all of your proactive, long-term, high-impact work. And then you switch modes into a more divergent mode for your manager's schedule for the second half of the day. And you do more of the reactive busy work that, you know, requires less kind of attentional depth and more just, you know, kind of immediate rapid fire.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I think another resource for people that I'm pretty sure we've either all read or are fans of is Cal Newport's Deep Work.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know, phenomenal.
As you're talking, I'm like, I'm pretty sure we all worship at the Church of Cal Newport.
exactly.
It's so good that. Yeah. I think actually, he did not put the word flow in it once. I've done a control F on the iBook. the word flow is not in there once, which is funny. But it's an amazing manual for hacking flow for knowledge workers. I think it's like one of the best go-to resources. So definitely people who want to get this.
Right. And when you're talking about your kind of your weekly, daily cycle there, I'm like, this sounds really familiar from some of my stuff. I was like, oh, you've taken his stuff and supercharged it with flow.
Yeah.
And just one more thing to add to that. So I'm going to completely misattribute and bastardize this quote. But it was about formulaic writing. I forget who actually this quote originates from, but the idea was that somebody was being very critical of formulaic writers, and the response was like, well, what's wrong with a good formula? Right? And I thought that was like such a good response. And so when it comes to setting clear goals and it comes to the habit formation, right, like it seems dry to be doing the same thing day after day after day, but like, what's wrong with a good formula, right? And then once you get that formula down correctly and you just look for all these subtleties and differences like in that formula, it's an incredibly satisfying place to be. And from a productivity perspective, from like a goal orientation perspective, right, like one of the biggest questions is like, am I focusing on the right thing? And like if you wake up first thing in the morning and like you start doing something and you're like, oh shit, wait, am I focusing on the right thing? That is the wrong question to be asking, because then you're just spending too many of your cognitive resources wondering that. And so I come from background in software tech development, and like where agile methodology is king, and you see the way that these agile projects are managed, and a good manager of an agile project will use pure agile, right? And so you set up a sprint in advance. A sprint can be an arbitrary length of time, but let's say you have a 1 week long sprint. So you set all of the expectations for that week of time in advance, and then you go and you like execute on that and have a retrospective at the end of it. And so like the good project managers are the ones who like come in and they're like, okay, we're going to like, set the expectations and we're going to go through this week. And the bad project managers are the ones who don't stick to that methodology, and halfway through they're like, oh, but by the way, we need to change this expectation over here. And like the impact that has is all of a sudden you have to do a context switch, and context switches are so expensive. And so if you don't set the preconditions right and commit to those preconditions, and you have to spend time trying to figure out, oh, am I doing the right thing? Oh shit, maybe I should be doing this thing over here. Like you're just going to be wasting time. And so that structure of like absolutely knowing that when you're working on a thing, you're working on the right thing, just saves so much of that cognitive entropy that we were talking about a moment ago.
But one of the things that's occurring to me as I'm listening to you is like, oh man, that's interesting. Maybe one of the upsides when people sort of push back on like, well, why do we have to do this in advance? It's like, well, think about how much more fun your week is going to be when you don't have the context switch.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. We just drop in and
you just get to go ride that zone for the week.
Yeah.
Like, that's exactly. Awesome.
The context switch is so expensive, right? Like all the psychology research supports the fact that like if we have to switch between contexts, like, we drastically reduce like the amount of, effort we're able to like actually put into the task that we want to complete. Yeah. And like, there's a lot of back and forth on what multitasking is, right? Like can we actually multitask? Like technically, yes, we can, right? There's something about like we can pay attention to something without giving it our full attention. However, like a lot of multitasking is actually quickly switching back and forth between like a task in a short period of time. And like, that's just an expensive operation to be in.
Yeah. Cal Newport, actually, funnily enough, in Deep Work talks about attention residue. I can't remember that. Sophie Leroy is the researcher. I can't remember where she's out of, but she kind of coined the term, and she refers to context switching, So let's say you start work on task A, and then you go to task B, even just for 5 minutes, and then you go back to task A, a certain residue or percentage of your attention is going to be fractured and left hanging on task B that you switched into. So even if they're both high priority, super productive, important tasks, you want to knock them out sequentially so you don't kind of rack up attention residue throughout and then constantly kind of, trickle away your attention as you're going.
So this is sort of like the science behind the well-worn and good advice to like single task, do one thing, finish it, then move on.
Exactly.
This is why.
But further to your comment about like tech personalities and, strategic thinking versus, convergent thinking, like, one thing that I think a lot about is there was a Harvard Business Review study that was looking at what are the best correlates to long-term business success. And like what they found was the best correlate to long-term business success is cognitive flexibility, right? It's the ability to deal with gray areas effectively.
Yeah.
And like that, like one thing that I think is a true mark of maturity. And, if you work in tech, you're used to working with younger personalities, right? Like at least least when you're working in the Bay, because, you know, the average age there is so young. And like the mark of kind of that youth and like that lack of fully developed maturity is optimizing for, you know, one metric or two metrics or a narrow number of metrics, right? Whether that's, you know, career success or their financial situation or whatever else. And I see this like across the board time and time again. And like, as you grow in maturity, you're optimizing for more and more things over time. And so your ability to kind of deal with gray areas and deal with a more complex optimization strategy, where like now I'm not just optimizing for my career, but I'm optimizing for my career plus my relationships, plus my physical health, plus whatever else. Like, you'll see that come over time, but that takes a lot of willingness to work with gray areas. And like, I've been on, you know, a number of different hiring panels, you know, over the course of my career, just because I really enjoy it. I really enjoy doing interviews with candidates and getting a sense for how they might work in an organization. And when you're on, like, in those conversations and you see the way all these managers think, a lot of them are like really like, they don't use this language specifically most of the time, but they're looking for that cognitive flexibility of like, okay, this person is great. You know, they did their PhD in physics, but can they switch context from doing like, you know, having had like this incredible success in academia to being in industry or being in industry in this specific domain? And like, that's a huge thing that you need to be able to cultivate over time.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And it goes back to meta skills and the primary competencies. You know, if you have those, like those base foundational things at play, like the ability to use your cognition effectively, the ability to be creative, drive yourself into flow, it's going to facilitate and enhance your ability to do well or, you know, win even as a meta skill across different domains, different areas, different tasks, et cetera.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So I want to kind of make this ultra concrete, right? Because mm-hmm. this is one of those things where it can, if not handled right, I feel like it can go in the fuzzy direction, and Please. Then people won't really like grab it and run with it. And that's really what I want for people and mm-hmm. and for all of us as well. So let's do a quick case study, and I want to give you guys a case, and I want to just throw it at you, and sure. like, let's just imagine how you would go. So let's take the tech example, mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of people like in that world who listen to this show. Mm-hmm. Let's take a product manager. Right. So this is someone who has to basically interface between many groups of stakeholders, many people they work with, from engineers to business people to internal and external to customers. So they're just there's a lot of scatteredness there. How would you
Sure.
remake that person's day, so to speak?
I mean, I can respond from my own personal experience because this is pretty challenging, right? So like, first off is like notifications are by definition, you know, the opposite of what you should be doing if you're looking to leverage attention at the yeah. present, right? Because it's just going to, you know, pull you out of any state that you're in. And it takes you a while to get back into flow if you can't even find flow again once you've been interrupted.
So is it fair to say, just as a quick, just a precondition kind of thing here? I know you guys have said flow follows focus a bunch of times here. So it mm-hmm. seems like the overarching principle is that this is a game of attention, and whatever it is you end up doing, whether it's on the list of published flow triggers or not, like, this is all a game of driving your attention fully into the present moment.
And exactly. All the triggers do are they help you drive that attention. And so like, if you're using risk as a flow trigger, you know, it's like, risk is one of the most potent ones you can use, right? Risky, as we discussed earlier, but like, it's one of the most potent ones that you can use. And so like, all of these things are just designed to allow you to improve the amount of focus or the amount of attention that you're spending on the present moment. And so like, when it comes to like notifications, first off, you know, like obviously all of those notifications should be silent as much as possible. But one thing that I found in my own experience, because I do, I manage a number of different data science projects. I do a lot of different consulting, or I'm in a lot of different consulting environments. And oftentimes you're on client sites, you're interacting with all different stakeholder groups. You're not able to control your environment in the same way that you can if you're, you know, if you're a programmer who's working remotely, who's able to, you know, deep dive into things for an extended period of time. And the heuristics or the rules of thumb that I found to be most effective in those cases is still to, you know, silence all those notifications for anybody that you're interacting with. You know, you give them your undivided attention, and you have to be very good at boundary setting as well. And so like boundary setting when you're dealing with new clients is like challenging to do, but you just have to get very good at, you know, setting aside time that allows you to actually do the thing that you do. But part of it, I think, is, you know, if you get into that mindset of when I do this thing and it is trying to scatter me because, you know, you walk into an office of, you know, one of your clients and then this person sees you as an expert in this field. And so they try and pull your attention in this way. And then somebody else is trying to pull your attention this way. And they're trying to change the scope of work. And so like you have to do this thing rather than that thing. Like just like making sure that you're giving things your undivided attention is challenging to do. But I think like I've been able to find flow in those projects by kind of celebrating the novelty behind it and celebrating the fact that, you know, all of these things are constantly changing. And so for instance, like one analogy I really like to use is, you know, I'm a long-term meditator. I've been meditating for over half a decade at this point. And when I first started meditating, I was living in Chicago. And so one of the few periods of time that I would have was on the train on my way to work in the morning. And so I would try and meditate in that environment and it's loud and there's chaotic and there's all sorts of stuff going on. But yeah. It's the same underlying problem, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how do you be present in the context of all of these changing variables around you? And one of the quotes that came to mind when I was in that state or when I was in that period of my life was, the world is your singing bowl. Right. And so if you think of like meditation, right, like you use a singing bowl, right? Like, you know, at the end of a meditation period or the beginning of a meditation period, whatever it might be. And that is a tool, that's a mechanism that's designed to kind of, you know, indicate that the meditation session has started or it's ended. And so it's designed to focus your attention. And so that quote, like the world is your singing bowl, is a way of saying that, you know, even amongst all of those distractions, you can use that as a focusing agent in order to be able to tune your ability to still focus, still maintain flow in a chaotic environment. Because a lot of what we're doing is we're teaching people to be more anti-fragile, right? We're teaching people how to retain their integrity in really challenging, chaotic environments. And so if you're an executive working in that environment, you have to deal with a tremendous amount of chaos, right? And so maintaining your integrity in the face of that is something that you build over time, but changing, reframing the situation as like these distractions are actually designed as a practice that allows me to refocus my attention rather than a distraction. I think that reframing exercise alone is one way that you can make these concepts a lot more concrete, even if you're not able to control every aspect of your environment in the way that, say, that programmer who works from home is able to do.
Yeah. Well, one point I would actually add, funnily enough, is literally just that in the same way that certain activities are more rich in flow triggers, some professional situations or setups or roles are actually just literally just more challenging to get into flow in, you know, so it's as simple as that. But once you know the triggers, once you know how you can drive yourself into flow, you can actually begin to like select for certain roles based on how they're going to help and facilitate you dropping into flow. Like I often used to, for whatever reason, use the example of a property developer with an activity or a job. Maybe I'm totally wrong on this because I've never done it, but that I imagine would be less conducive to flow in that you're kind of on the phone for 5 minutes and then you're in the car for a little bit going to, you know, visit a site and then you're talking to another person, you're on a deal. So I think there's just less room or scope for being able to drop into flow in certain roles. And obviously everything Connor's pointed to, I think, will help and assist no matter what the situation is. But it is also important to be aware of that fact. And then another thing I would add that can make a difference regardless of how conducive to flow your specific role or situation is the idea of flow proneness and basic flow hygiene. So we're evolutionarily wired for flow, at least that's what we hypothesize. Your system wants to drive itself into flow, but a lot of people's basic habits and ways of living and lifestyles make that extremely difficult. They're constantly fighting their biology rather than leveraging their biology to drive themselves into flow. So for example, you know, maybe they sleep terribly. And, you know, if you're massively underslept, massively over caffeinated, and you can't even hold focus on something for a few minutes because you're just exhausted, you're less likely to get into flow. If you've got really severe back pain because you sit all the time and you don't use a standing desk and you don't do any kind of physical mobility work, that back pain is going to be gnawing at you, fracturing your attention and making it less likely that you can drop into flow. You know, if you eat a sugary donut or whatever at 11 o'clock at lunch, and you get a splitting headache an hour and a half later, the chances are that you're less likely to get into flow. So you want to be aware of all these like systemic, holistic habits and behaviors that I think can heighten your flow proneness in general. So they're almost like a backdrop to the flow triggers. And the more on point you get with all of those, again, basic like peak performance habits, the more likely you are to get into flow, and the more your system is kind of wired and set up and primed to be able to get into flow.
Right. And I just to add one more thing. So we talked about the challenge skill balance as being the golden rule of flow. If you're in a chaotic environment like that, where, you know, you're dealing with tons of different stakeholders, colleagues, you know, managers, whatever it might be, you need to leverage a lot of the strategies from group flow instead, which operates a little bit differently.
Talk about that. So
group flow. So just as individual flow, the challenge skill balance is, you know, the golden rule for group flow, which is, you know, flow that a group of people get into. And probably the best example of this is surgeons, right? We're surgical teams. They're all so focused on a shared goal that those teams just get into flow like nobody else, because they have a shared level of expertise, right? They all know exactly what's happening. They have a shared goal, right? Which is to complete that surgery. They have a common vocabulary. And so like leveraging those sets of triggers is very important. But the let's say the golden rule of group flow is the so-called yes and principle. And so this comes straight out of improv, right? And so like in improv, any conversation you have is always additive. And so like, you know, if say the setup for your improv game is, you know, you have an old man who's sitting on a bench and somebody walks up to them and makes some sort of comment, right? Like the old man can't just sit there and be like, oh no, I'm impervious to everything. Like I'm not going to respond to that, right? Like your conversations that you have when you're trying to maximize for group flow are always additive. And so you're always saying yes, and you're contributing something to that conversation. And so like you can see this in a number of different ways. I mean, you can literally say yes and to somebody, and it's crazy how like infectious that becomes in conversations when you do that. You can use language of like, oh, I agree with you, and I would add, right? Like all of that language, like it makes other people feel validated. It makes them feel like you're understanding what they're saying. If you're mimicking their gestures, or if you're you know, summarizing what they said back to them, it gives them a sense of like, oh yeah, you understood what I said, and you're adding something to it. And so like being able to leverage that of like always kind of saying yes and then adding something to it just allows you to tap into flow when you're in more of those dynamic environments.
I did an improv class actually, funnily enough, last week for the first time, and he was talking about yes and we were doing these like live two-person improv stories, and I noticed myself constantly not yes anding and like trying to cut the dude down. Right. And I realized, it was interesting to realize during it, that it's actually like being Irish and the whole kind of banter culture that is literally the opposite of yes and.
Oh, wow.
I was like, I noticed my mind being like, how can I take the piss out of this dude? How can I cut him down? Rather than how can I yes and them. So it's interesting to notice as well, like there's obviously these cultural influences for all of this stuff too. So
that's fascinating. I've heard of that. That's so interesting. Yeah. So it seems like to your point, Rian, you made a minute ago, like there's kind of the like table stakes sort of flow hygiene, so to speak. Right. Yeah. And it seems like it would sort of fall into the buckets of like, you know, body, mind and attention, which is sort of mind, but let's split it on its own. It's, you know, bodies like sleep, exercise, nutrition, are you in pain, have you moved today? mind is, you know, we've talked a lot about distractions and attention, but one thing I've heard or seen crop up in the research was around things like more of some of the positive psychology practices around like gratitude and mindfulness and actually having social contact and things like that. Do those actually play a role in flow as well?
I would love to take this one. Yeah, if you don't mind. So first off, yes, absolutely. I can take those like mindfulness and gratitude separately. Gratitude is something that we're currently actively studying. And so if you think about what gratitude is, you can think about gratitude in two different dimensions. You know, one is gratitude as a personality trait. And so, you know, certain people, generally speaking, are more grateful. And you can also view this as a habit, right? Some people, you know, go home at night and they, you know, have a gratitude journal that they keep. And so we're currently doing research with University of Southern California on this issue. And so the idea is, are people who are more grateful more prone to flow? And part of this, like one of like the motivating narratives that we found within this that is, you know, fueling this research is first, we know a lot of these things in positive psychology are correlated, right? Mindfulness practice and gratitude are obviously two correlated things. But when it comes to one story that we heard, which was, I believe it was an X Games snowboarder who was feeling incredibly overwhelmed before dropping into this massive half pipe and, you know, going through and, you know, competing against her competitors. And so her story of this was that, you know, she was sitting up there on half pipe, feeling completely overwhelmed, and then looking out over the crowd and seeing how much support that she was getting from this crowd and just feeling an incredible amount of gratitude for it.
Yeah.
And she went on to win this competition. And so the idea being that, you know, gratitude, whether it's a personality trait that you have or whether it's an in-situation way that you deal with stress, could be one way of reducing the amount of stress that you have and allowing you to tap into flow. And so this is, you know,
is that sort of like reducing where you are on that y-axis of the challenge skills balance.
Exactly. Right. Like if you're like, so like one reason why, like if you're on like the anxiety side of the challenge skill balance, right. If you're feeling really anxious about something and you're too anxious, you have too much either adrenaline or cortisol, right. Stress hormones in your system. If you have too much of that in your system, it's going to block your ability to access flow. And so one way of reducing the amount of stress that you have is by increasing your sense of social support, right? So how supported am I from the people around me? And so like, if you imagine this woman like sitting out there looking out over this half pipe before like this competition and feeling that sense of gratitude for all of the support that she's receiving, all of a sudden, all of her psychological safety needs are met because she has this incredible amount of support. And so she is able to deal with a more stressful environment because she has that. And so this is our hypothesis, right? Like we have yet to like fully validate it, but that's where we're kind of going with this. And we know that generally speaking, you know, positive psychology basics means that having a gratitude practice is really, really important for general well-being. And so that's one half of the question. The other half of the question is in terms of mindfulness. And so generally we say that, you know, mindfulness is also, you know, a absolute necessity. And so we generally say that either a rigorous exercise regimen or mindfulness is a necessity. You have to have at least one of the two. Ideally, you have both of them. And the reason for that is to increase your ability to self-regulate. And so it's, you know, making your emotions have a little bit less control over you. And so people who have a rigorous exercise routine and people who have a mindfulness routine are able to increase their level of self-awareness, increase their level of emotional regulation, which is allowing them to tune the amount of stress that they have when they're in a stressful situation and retain their sense of integrity and goal directedness while they're under that level of stress.
Mm. Mindfulness also trains focused attention as well. So it's helpful indirectly in that respect, in that mindfulness trains focus. And just one thing I was going to mention, a nice book on this whole topic is called The Happiness Advantage by Sean Aker. He's a psychologist at Harvard. He had, I think, the most popular class in Harvard for a couple of years on this whole, all of this stuff and on positive psychology. And the premise of that book essentially is just that positive affect or positive emotion or happiness is a competitive advantage, and it heightens and improves various cognitive faculties like divergent thinking and things like that. So doing a gratitude practice, doing things that help you self-regulate and facilitate positive emotion also improve performance.
Yeah. So we talked a lot about someone working in a chaotic environment, right? So someone where let's just say the environment is not ideal for it's not that flow conducive. How would you advise someone who maybe doesn't have that much control of their schedule, whether that's someone else is controlling their strategy and the tasks that they do, or literally like even someone working like in a factory where they, you know, they have very regimented what they have to do at certain times. So,
One way I like to think about autonomy is that, I think we were talking about this at dinner, is that you can gain autonomy by being able to do things you want to do. And then you can gain autonomy also through cognitive reframing by wanting to do things you have to do. So if you can't change the actual thing, the thing you can change and that you do have control over is your own individual desire. And there's different ways that you can manipulate or influence your own desire to do something. But that is an immediate and pretty instant way to gain more autonomy, is to actually decide for yourself, no, actually, I do want to do this. One way that I think is very helpful to do that is to have some kind of North Star or massively transformative purpose or overarching goal or long-term plan. And then even if the job you're doing right now is shit and you hate it and you can't stand any of the tasks that you have to do, you know that you've chosen the North Star, you've chosen the thing that you're ultimately working towards. And so then it brings the thing that previously felt like you didn't have autonomy within under your own volition and gives you autonomy in it through cognitive reframing. So I think that's a helpful immediate way. And then obviously overall, you want to be working towards getting more actual, you know, like literal autonomy as well.
Riffing on that, you know, we were talking about this at dinner. There's this idea that Csikszentmihalyi had of I think it was him, of like vital engagement.
Yeah.
Right. Of that sort of. So I was hoping you could do two things. One, and maybe they come together. Like they seem to in my mind. We'll see if they actually do. One, what is that idea? And two, I don't know if you two have talked about this together before, but I know you have, Rian, is if you could talk a little bit about the way you frame passion and purpose and make a distinction between the two. I found it to be quite useful the first time I heard it. So maybe you could explain that.
Sure. But I love the notion of vital engagement. Csikszentmihalyi writes about it in, God, I think it's Beyond Boredom and Anxiety. I can't remember which one it is. But he doesn't talk about it that much elsewhere. But essentially, it's just this effect that seems to happen when you're having lots of individual flow state experiences, but they're all under the rubric of some overarching mission or vision or goal that you've set for yourself.
That North Star,
exactly. So what happens, let's say you've got like, I don't know, a 30-year ultimate objective and you're getting into flow on a Monday afternoon and then again on a Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Outside of the acute or specific flow experiences, the rest of your life, even when you're not technically in a flow state, gets infused with this sense of meaning because it's all entangled and wrapped up and packaged against this overarching North Star that you're ultimately aiming at. And I've experienced this even like extremely strongly myself. People often refer to it as momentum, feeling like they're gaining momentum or they're in like a state of momentum. And all of a sudden, you know, getting your bank account set up for your company that you're building is like, it's exciting as hell. It's satisfying as hell. It's like, yes.
Paperwork.
Yeah, it's exactly. Like you did a form. It's like obviously, obviously you're not in a flow state where you're filling out the form, but it's tied under the narrative that is immensely meaningful and that has lots of flow states populated throughout it. That is, that just adds and drives meaning and creates that sense of what he calls vital engagement or what a lot of people call momentum. And then as far as passion and purpose, I think Stephen has a cleaner way of defining or distinguishing between them that I've forgotten. But essentially, passion is you loving the thing or enjoying whatever the thing is.
Like the activity?
The activity, yeah, exactly. Mm. So being passionate about, I don't know, whatever it is, writing. And then purpose is that thing having some kind of impact externally or on others. So then when you take passion and you add it to purpose, it sort of turbocharges the whole process. So you're not just loving writing, but you're loving writing and but simultaneously knowing that it's going to positively impact the lives of others or whatever, you know, purpose it may have for you.
Right. And I think one way to balance this out is, so there's a lot of talk of like passion and motivation versus discipline. And so in the high performance space, it seems like people are kind of split down the middle, right? Where like, you know, the people who are like passion, motivation tend to be a little bit critical of the discipline people, and the discipline people are like, why are you doing passion, motivation? Because these things, you know, are not long-term sustainable. And so if you like wake up one day and you're not passionate, then like you're screwed. What are you going to do? And so like, I think what you're seeing in this space is a lot of interest in the Stoics on the one hand. And so like, you know, Tim Ferriss is really interested in the Stoics. Ryan Holiday is really interested in the Stoics, like especially in tech, you see a lot of this interest in the Stoics, which is about, you know, discipline and rationality over time. And then on the other side, you see people who are a little bit more interested in flow, people who are interested in this autotelic personality that we're talking about. And, you know, sometimes we refer to this as like the hedonic way of doing something similar, because, you know, flow leverages all sorts of, you know, intrinsic motivators. And so I think like there's no right answer, right? Like if you think of like these two different camps, one is looking at, you know, motivation and passion, and flow and autotelic personality, and the other camp that's looking for discipline, and willpower. Stoicism and willpower. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, regiment, like doing the same regimented thing day after day. I think these are, should be viewed as, you know, two different arrows in your quiver, and you should be able to leverage both of them. But like right now, it seems like, you know, I feel like people are way too one-sided when they approach this and say like, oh, it's either this thing or it's like the other thing, right? Like it's either the discipline or it's the passion. And like, you know, the discipline people just hate the passion people, right? Like for some reason, like you read Ryan Holiday's books and like, it's just like, you know, like really critical of it. Or you read like, you know, Tim Ferriss quoting like Marcus Aurelius and like, you know, they're like these really heavy hitting quotes about like the need for like, you know, repetition and like discipline, which I think is essentially stupid, right? Like you should be able to navigate both both sides of that territory well. And like when you run out of passion, when you run out of motivation, you know, that's when like the discipline comes in of like, oh, I'm going to continue to do this thing. I'm going to continue to drive productive value for my time on this planet. And I'm going to expect over time that motivation and passion to return.
Related to that is the idea of grit, right? Like, Angela Duckworth has talked so prominently about that. And I love her book, right? It's that idea of passion and perseverance, right? You need them both because it's a long run. And what actually related to that, one question that I was wondering about is, I think, speaking about another sort of luminary in the space of peak performance and human potential, and like who's someone who's on the cutting edge of exploring, like how far can we take this human thing, is, Anders Ericsson. Right. Yeah. So, you know, the godfather of deliberate practice. Right. And one of the things I was wondering about is the relationship between deliberate practice and flow. And the reason this just came to mind was they seem to be related, but not the same thing, in the sense that like when I think of deliberate practice in a very orthodox definition of that, of what that is, it's sort of this hyper aware level of like feedback. Like they share a lot of commonalities, but the level of intensity with which you're like self-analyzing and getting feedback in a deliberate practice setting, which is exhausting, seems kind of contradictory to the arising of flow, whereas, and flow maybe is a different experience. I'm just curious what you've seen or your thoughts on the relationship between those two things.
The way I conceptualize it, at least, is that, again, the way I kind of view it again, is that like flow sits underneath all of this stuff. And then you've got like deliberate practice, or again, as we were talking about earlier, you know, the specific skill or implementation of whatever it is that you're doing on top of that. Sometimes you're going to be in flow when you're doing that. Sometimes you're not going to be in flow when you're doing it. The point Anders Ericsson is great at making is that you should just show up and do it anyway, and that you need a hell of a lot of hours probably to get good at the thing. So I think that they are definitely like synergistic and complementary, and it's definitely not like one way or the other. The one thing I am critical of is the whole 10,000 hours notion. I mean, it's totally and utterly arbitrary. But anyway, that's kind of been debunked. But I love the notion of deliberate practice and the idea of very intentionally getting better at a thing and figuring out how it is that you can improve systematically and constantly at a thing. And then that kind of intersects or relates to clear goals also. So I think that they are separate, but interrelated and definitely complementary.
One way I think, the way I heard it put, I think actually this might've been in Angela Duckworth's book, Grit, was that, deliberate practice was for preparation and flow is for performance. In the sense that like deliberate practice is this very, very intense, deliberate, to use the word, thing you do as you're practicing and preparing. But then flow is far more likely to be an experience that arises in a performance context where you're not actually doing that self-analysis. Because like that sort of self-critical nature is a little bit, seems to me a little bit antithetical to flow, to the arising of flow. And that's very much what you're doing in a deliberate practice setting, is you're deliberately looking at that, you know, that critical nature. But then in a performance context, you know, it's the difference between like, you know, somebody on a football team runs a play and then they're looking at the film and analyzing it versus like it's game time. Right. And I think you probably hit it more in the game than.
But even when you're in like that period of practice, like I would argue that you're still trying to tap into flow when you're in that period of practice, because like when you tap into flow, your sense of self is starting to dilate. Right. And so your sense of self-awareness acts differently, right? Like your sense of ego, it gets pulled out of the equation. And so you don't want to be rigorously self-critical at the point that you're doing that. However, you know, you want to be able to, you know, go and do whatever your activity of, you know, choice is, right? If it's downhill skiing, you want to be able to, you know, ski that run without any sense of, you know, self-criticism, self-awareness, drop into that state. And then when you're on the lift back up, then you're analyzing what you did and analyzing what you could have done better. And so even within that, like you don't want to promote this idea that you need to be, I don't know, like overly logically aware of what you're doing while you're doing that. Like you want a degree of presence, but you don't want a sense of being outside of yourself per se, because then you're too focused on, you know, how it is that you're appearing from an outside perspective. And when you do that, you're losing your ability to actually be, you know, in that moment, navigating that situation.
You know, actually, as I'm listening to you, that makes a lot of sense, because it seems like I think I had just combined two different ideas. One was the sort of rational, analytical, like post-game analysis, right?
It's
like,
yeah, cool, that's what I was going to say.
Go watch the film, right?
That's afterwards.
That's what the film session's for, you know, the next or that afternoon or whatever. And then you take the lessons and go back to the field the next day and practice. I think I had combined that idea with the idea of clear goals in a deliberate practice sense of like, you know, I'm thinking of a musician, right? Who's trying to like, let's imagine a guitar player who's trying to like nail a really hard pattern, a lick on the fretboard. And in a way that is a clear goal, right? You are trying to do this one thing and you're busting your ass trying to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think what I had confused was the type of feedback loop you're getting into there where you're okay, I'm not there yet. You're tweaking and you're adjusting, trying to get there with that sort of analytical feedback loop. And they do seem different.
Yeah, I think you want to separate them sort of similarly to the strategy and execution thing. Like the post-game analysis analogy is perfect. And most of the sports psychologists that I know would say as well that you want there to be as little difference as possible between practice and performance. But I think the reason that you're more likely potentially to get into flow while actually performing is, again, actually comes down to triggers. Risk, for example, is heightened significantly when actually performing. But I don't think you want to do anything inherently different apart from be more conscious of how you can improve. But again, that usually takes place after the fact of the practice whilst, you know, going throughout the practice phase.
Yeah. There's also something about you that knows like when it's game time, which is like really interesting. And I see this like in skydiving, like this always happens, even with somebody who's doing their very first skydive, you know, a tandem skydive strapped to an instructor, where it's like, you're nervous. But as soon as you're out of that plane, it's like, well, what the fuck are you going to do now? Right? Like you're not going back up, right? You can't flap your wings and go back up. And so like, as soon as you're actually in that moment, then you have a tendency to drop into it. And so I think that's one part about performance that, you know, really differentiates it from practice, where, you know, practice, you're allowing yourself to, you know, practice that guitar lick, and then like, oh, you messed up that note, and so you're going to stop and you're going to redo it, right? Like you never do that when you're actually doing that performance. And so there's something about the commitment that's, you know, associated with that act that allows you to, I think, optimize for actually tapping into flow, because you know that, you know, that
it's game time.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And there's no alternative. Like you hit this point of no return, and this happens, you know, every skydive, every base jump, like you hit that point of no return, and then like something magical happens where like, you know, the external chatter starts to cease. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm in like this situation. You might have, you know, a perilous situation where, you know, you open up your parachute and like all of your lines are wrapped up and you have to do something about it, but you're not sitting there, you know, overly worrying about it. You're solving the situation because you know you're you know, past this point of commitment.
Yeah.
So we're going to start to wrap up here with a couple more. There'll be some rapid fire questions, but I want to actually ask one last question that's specifically about the work environment for people. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm actually sneaking in two questions here, so we'll do them one at a time. The first one was going back to that challenge skill balance. If you have people who, let's say, the role that they're playing in a particular job or company or whatever isn't that stimulating to them, right? Maybe it's something where they're doing sort of a little bit more rote work, things like that, and just they're not lit up by the fundamental activity they're doing. What can someone in that type of situation do to make their experience better, you know, aside from just leave and get a different job? Like let's imagine for whatever reason they're in that job, what can they do to make that job better?
I mean, you can tune the challenge skills balance. Like you can play with it through manipulating or tweaking whatever situation you're in. So for example, I mean, an ultra simple example is you've got to, I don't know, bang out a project by 1 o'clock or by lunchtime, just make it that you've got to finish it by 11 o'clock. And then you've artificially raised the challenge level by putting a time constraint on getting whatever that thing is done. And there's all sorts of different ways that you can do that. You know, you can artificially induce heightened challenge by doing tons of different things within the work environment. You can just try and double your target for yourself personally. You could try and, again, like complete all your work by lunchtime every day if it's mundane and boring as hell. I think there's lots of ways you can get creative to make the thing harder, like making a thing harder.
If you're bored, you got to dial up the challenge.
Exactly. If you're bored, it's understimulating. Find fun ways to make it harder and pose challenges for yourself within the situation.
Yeah, I think one tool that's really effective is like imagine the instruction that I think every parent gives to kids, right? When like they're bored and it's like, no, like you figure out a way to make this thing interesting, right? And I think it's a lesson that, you know, you have to learn at it. Like a lot of kids learn at an early age, a lot of people don't. And you have to learn as an adult if you didn't learn it as a kid, which is, you know, if I'm in this situation and it's not sufficiently challenging, I need to find a way to make it interesting and challenging for myself. And so you do need to reframe that situation. And so I remember being inspired by 4-hour work week many years ago. And so I was working a job that I wasn't hugely, you know, interested in, or like it was, you know, a lot of, you know, admin work that, you know, at the moment I thought that it was, you know, beneath me and it was boring. And so my goal was to, you know, take the 4-hour work week pretty literally and try and complete my work in four hours.
Right, exactly.
And then, you know, spend the rest of, you know, the day. I still had to be in the office, but I wanted to, you know, study this, you know, like side project that I was working on. And so that's exactly what I did. And like, it actually worked really well to be like, I literally got my work week down to 4 hours.
Yeah.
And then I would spend the rest of the time doing either freelancing on the side or studying. And like that allowed me to do that. But like being able to reframe your situation and just being able to, I don't know, like find complexity and interest in like situations that might not be intrinsically as stimulating, I think is really important. Because if you don't learn that skill, you're going to be on the hedonic treadmill, right? You're always going to be looking for more and more like, you know, interesting environments. And like that isn't necessarily the best mindset. Like, you know, being able to manipulate by reframing is, you know, a crucial life lesson.
Yeah.
Talk to me, let's pop up from the individual level and actually even above the group level. And I want to talk very briefly about the environment itself. Like how does one create an environment that is more conducive to flow? Like just imagine an office environment.
Obviously ultimately it comes down to practices and policies, and there's lots of different specifics. One big thing is encouraging asynchronous communication, I think, so that you're not breaking people's focus on whatever it is they're doing by forcing them to both come in and sit in a meeting at the same time. So that's a big one. I know a lot of, you know, tech companies do that. Emphasizing and building a culture around focus and deep work is a big one. I think in many respects, offices, at least during certain periods of the day, should be more like libraries. In terms of silence and in terms of just people who are actually focusing on, you know, executing, getting things done. And then related to that, obviously batching communication into certain set periods. Basecamp and Jason Fried. Yeah, all of this stuff he's amazing on. Mm-hmm. They have phenomenal overall
their
practices.
Library rules.
Exactly. They're like a phenomenal case study on flow, actually, and what we would recommend a company to do.
Awesome. We'll link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, he's great. And he does a lot of that stuff. Yeah, asynchronous communication, batching, again, like sprints, you know, because that minimizes the amount of communication that needs to happen throughout the actual week. You can let people execute. Stand-ups are good. So, you know, you knock out the sync at the start of the day and then you get into it for the rest of the day, being very conscious and cognizant of timing meetings, setting things up from a high level structurally so that constant back and forth communication is minimized and isn't that much of a requirement. Not having policies around, you know, needing people to have like turnaround times for email or Slack messages and things like that. Obviously giving workers as much autonomy as possible, holding them to performance standards rather than to, you know, process standards. So, you know, delegating outcomes rather than delegating tasks, I think is a big one that enhances autonomy and allows for people to be creative as far as how to get them done. So I think there's all sorts of different ways to deploy it specifically. And once you understand the fundamental triggers and what's required to be able to get into flow, you can creatively think about how you can deploy this stuff within your own work environment as effectively as possible.
Exactly. And just to add to that, obviously no open air work environments, you know, obviously there are real estate considerations to this. And the reason why, you know, people put a bunch of, you know, desks side by side is, you know, more financial reasons than anything else. But that just kills productivity.
Yeah, it's like open office plans, you mean?
Exactly. I mean, exactly.
The amount of people who have to go to coffee shops to actually get work done, or like say they can't come in for a day a week so that they can actually hit the deadlines that they've been delegated. You know, like offices, at least in my experience, are often amongst the most unproductive places to be. So, you know, you want your office to be somewhere where people can actually get work done. And I know it sounds incredibly basic, but most aren't. You know, I know so many offices where it's six people sitting around a table facing each other kind of thing and talking every minute or two, or, you know, they just check in on something. Like, it's just...
So one of the things, when you're talking about the, you know, minimize all that back and forth communication that would interrupt people from their focus, right? But then I was just scanning my notes really quick and looking at some of the flow triggers. And I, one of the ones on group flow was constant communication. So how is that different?
Well, that's when I say batching communication, when you have a specific chunk of time dedicated to communication, then you want to try and make that time conducive to group flow and ideally facilitate a group flow state within a specific brainstorming session. But the situation we're talking about, where it's back and forth, constant bits of communication, you're not going to get group flow and you're not going to get individual flow. You're just getting fractured attention and no real solid group flow or good communication and no real individual flow or actual focus. So you're kind of like, you're caught between two ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. Is there such a thing as like group flow in a normal meeting, or like, is like the weekly staff meeting just a waste, or what would you, is there a way to have that be flow, or what do you
yeah,
do?
So I think
there's a lot of value to that, because, you know, everybody's speaking like the same language, they have similar expertise. And so a lot of people get into group flow when they're in that sort of meeting. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really, you know, helpful to have everybody engaged, not just one person dictating the schedule. And so like, say agile stand-up meetings, I think are really, really effective, because everybody's bringing, you know, their tasks to the fore, they're bringing their blockers, and, you know, they're all speaking a common language. So I think there is a lot of value to that. And then I guess like two things to add to what Rianne is saying, like, I just want to echo the autonomy piece. I think the much of the progress that you get, much of the benefits you get is out of giving your employees a high degree of autonomy. And if you can't trust your employees, then why did you hire them to begin with?
Yeah.
Right. And so like micromanagement just absolutely kills flow.
Yeah. Yep.
And then the other piece is when it comes to immediate feedback. And so like feedback on a weekly clip or a daily clip is ideal. Mm-hmm. None of this quarterly or yearly review cycles. By the time you get a yearly review, mm-hmm. you have no idea what it refers to. Like, none of that stuff's actionable. It refers to like a version of yourself that existed 6 months ago, right?
Yeah, can't even remember it.
Exactly. And so being able to do this like using weekly like cycles. And so, for instance, 15.5 is a fantastic tool
for
this.
Yep.
And so... for those of you who are unfamiliar, right? So at the end of, you fill this out once a week. And so it's supposed to take you about 15 minutes to fill out and your manager about 5 minutes to go through it, which is hence the name 15.5. But it goes through what the goals were that you defined the previous week. You give an update on those, you define goals for the next week, and you talk about your challenges and your successes, and you can add arbitrary, you know, high fives to other people and what else on top of that. I find that to be so effective because it keeps everybody goal driven. It's a really good way of upward reporting as well at a very high level. But that level of feedback allows you to deal with blockers and challenges at a much faster clip, because like the goal was to be able to like, you know, speed up business cycles as much as possible, right? You know, the mantra in the valley is, you know, speed up the time to failure. And so like, you want to be able to speed that up as much as possible, and getting those immediate feedback cycles, in place in a way that's helpful and relevant and actionable, is another fantastic way to improve workplace culture.
Right. Exactly. Like having well set OKRs or KPIs. Accountability is an interesting one as well, because accountability comes with autonomy, or at least has to if it's being, you know, rationally given, at least in any way. So giving people numbers to own, things like that. I know Sam Walton with Walmart, what they do, or did, I don't know if they still do it, within their big mega stores, is they'd make each department a sub-department and have it have its own set of books and have it have its own targets, and then have the store manager for each sub-department, like the sporting goods department or whatever, run that department singularly and be held accountable to hitting numbers for that specific department within the overarching store, so that that person is given much more autonomy over that, you know, subcomponent of the overall mega store.
Yeah, I love that. That ties in beautifully with some of the prior episodes of this podcast. Like one in particular that comes to mind is the conversation with Christina Wickie about creating high performing, autonomous, mindful teams. And a lot of it echoes, like, it's, I'm sort of seeing this. This is very interesting as a conversation, because you're like, oh, this is sort of the psychological side of maybe a lot of reasons why that works. Mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting one. And just to your thing you were saying, Connor, about 15.5, they actually, just as a shout out, they have a great podcast as well that everyone should check out. Yeah, it's called they started it sometime last year. It's called the Best Self-Management Podcast. It's excellent.
Nice. So nice.
Shout out for them. Sick. Big fan of their show. So, first of all, I just got to say thank you, guys. This has been such a fun, like, I don't know, I've been in flow in this conversation. It's been a little mini group flow.
No, it's been fantastic. How many, it's been what, like 3 hours now? No,
it's been almost 3 hours. Oh my God. You know, because we were jamming before we even hit record. So for the listener, like, you just got to be part of our group flow. So first of all, thank you guys so much for your time, for your expertise, for sharing your experience and your wisdom. And it's so exciting. And I'm really a huge fan of the two of you and what you all are up to. So my last question is there anything, do you have any, for people who are listening to this, is there anything you'd ask of them, any asks you want to make of the audience, and where can they engage more with you?
I'd say check us out on flowresearchcollective.com. We've got a newsletter there. We send it out every week. It's always super high value, at least we think, with articles and content and ways to learn more. And then you can check us out on social as well. So Flow Research Collective on Instagram, Facebook, same thing, website, newsletter. Yeah, exactly. All that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess like the takeaway I'd like people to leave with is like, yes, they are programmable. Yes, you can, you know, use these tools in order to get more flow in your life. And there are any number of books and resources, and we can link those in the show notes. But usually people ask for, you know, what's the common denominator for resources to check out. And I always recommend Rise of Superman by Stephen Kotler, and the original book Flow by Csikszentmihalyi. That one's a little bit more academic, and so it depends on, you know, how much you want to work with, you know, a little bit more technical writing. And so Rise of Superman is, you know, very compelling narratives about action sport athletes, and then the book Flow is going to scratch that itch if you're more of a technical person. But if you have that sort of mindset where you view yourself as, you know, someone who can change given the right amount of time and effort, you can manipulate all of these knobs and levers to get a ton of flow in your life. Yeah. You won't be in flow all the time, but you'll get a hell of a lot of it.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, guys, thanks so much for the time, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. Yeah, thanks for having us.
If what you've heard on Flow Research Collective Radio has been helpful, please consider doing us a solid and leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are listening to this. Reviews help us connect to a wider audience so we can get these peak performance principles out to more people.